You don't have to explain yourself.
Good morning, everyone. I'd like to open the February 27, 2014 meeting of the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. Good morning to everyone. We have a full agenda this morning. We're going to be having informational hearings on both the Oregon Hatchery Research Center as well as unmanned aerial systems. And with that, I'm going to open an informational meeting on the Oregon Hatchery Research Center. I would like to call forward Director ODF&W, and Roy, anyone else that you would like to bring up with you is...
Yes, sir. I'd also...
Most welcome.
...also be joined up here by Dr. Dan Edge, who's the head of the Fisheries and Wildlife Section at Oregon State University and our partner at the Research Center.
Professor Edge, welcome.
Thank you.
Mr. Director, welcome to you. Thank you for coming this morning. We appreciate your appearance.
Well, it's all my pleasure to be here this morning, and I do want to also congratulate Representative and Vice Chair Representative Esquivel for a very nice function last night, sir.
Well, thank you. Looks like the same group.
Yeah, and I managed not to leave a lot of money last night, but I left some.
Well, Director, we'll do better next time.
So, Mr. Chair, Vice Chairs, and members of the committee and members of the Coastal Caucus, welcome this morning. My name is Roy Elliker, and I am the director of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And, you know, most of this time today, I want to yield to the chair and vice chairs of the new advisory board for the Oregon Hatchery Research Center. So I just want to make a few short introductory remarks before I turn it over to them, and then, of course, I think Professor Edge has a few introductory remarks as well. So a couple things. So we're here to talk about how the department and OSU and a lot of other people have started to implement House Bill 3441 from last session. You know what, we had quite a bit of discussion on this bill, as we all know, and it came with many letters of support and a lot of support from this body that we needed to see, and this body requested, particularly from OSU and ODF&W, a recommitment to the Hatchery Research Center, and a commitment that would follow through as to, I guess, in some ways, some of the goals and vision that first had this body set up the Hatchery Research Center and fund the Hatchery Research Center to get it started. So I guess, you know, as the governor signed this bill and it came over to my desk for implementation and for my staff's desks, you know, I really took this as that this body in front of me, the legislature and the governor, was asking for a recommitment of the Department of Oregon State and the science and the fisheries, the educational and the coastal communities towards this facility and what it could achieve as a science center. Because after all, this science center is always, will be about and is about the fish, particularly salmon, the most important fish for everyone who is an Oregonian, at heart or otherwise. So, you know, as my good friend Lindsey Ball likes to say, the Hatcher Research Center is the hub of this science about salmon, and the state of Oregon is going to be the lab. And I think you will see that in these proposals that come forward from the board today, the three proposals they're going to talk to you about. So anyway, I did want to refer to the report in front of you. Page 11 is the actual House Bill 3441, and it talks in detail about the implementation and the establishment of the new board. So we did that, if you go to page 4, right up front, it talks, the new board is listed there. The requirements and who we should consider for this board was carefully laid out in House Bill 3441. But, you know, as the person who was there and was asked to appoint this board, I solicited input from many folks around the state. And we tried to look for a board of balance, but with particularly science expertise on fisheries and salmon. We wanted some academia, we wanted some fishermen, we wanted folks that, in the end, had a real passion for salmon, but understood that this science center is kind of a long-term project. and that there's not going to be any quick fixes here as we start to look at these differences between hatchery fish and wild fish. But in the end, it will enable us to have better hatcheries, more salmon, more fisheries for the citizens of Oregon. So myself and the department, along with Dr. Edge at OSU and Dr. Noakes, went to work immediately to start thinking about strategic direction for the new board. We knew we had just a short amount of time to put together this first report for this committee. We were able to meet three times in that span of time. And I think the heart of the report that Chair Camperi and his two vice chairs are going to bring forward to you are these three proposals that were asked for by many legislators to kind of get down the road a little bit more on the science issues and the commitment to hatchery and versus wild salmon research. But I guess here, as I close and turn this over to Dr. Edge, I do want to say that the legislature has asked for this recommitment to the center, and you have it. But now the state of Oregon is going to ask the legislature for a recommitment to the center, probably next session, because the business model that the center was built on, founded on, which was, well, we'll fund the running of the facility, and then other scientists will bring money there to do research, that didn't really pan out very well. We do have good research going on, but not the kind of research exactly, perhaps, that folks envisioned, the cutting-edge research, the big research. So, you know, we are going to be coming back to this body with a funding request, actually, for research at the center. That's the heart of the proposals that we have in front of you today to consider, not this session, obviously, but certainly for next session. And I would ask for an open mind, and as hard as that can be, particularly when we come to talk about money, but money will be needed if we're going to move the Science Center, the Hatch Research Center, to a new level, to really become generally a regional center for science for salmon research. We're going to need state funding. And so we'll be coming back along with the new advisory board to have that discussion next session. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair, Co-Chair, members of the committee, and members of the Coastal Caucus. Appreciate the opportunity to come and talk today as well. Once again, I'm Dan Edge. I'm the department head down at Oregon State University in the Department of Fisheries and Wildlife, and we are a major collaborator in the Oregon Hatchery Research Center. I'm just delighted to say that we had another good year, I think, on the Hatchery Research Center, and Oregon State University very much appreciates the access to this facility. It is world-class. It is top-notch. We do have a board up and running. I'm delighted at the members of the board. As Roy said, they've met three times, and they all seem to be very engaged and very interested in the process. So I'm delighted at how quickly we've been able to move forward after the bill last year. You've got a copy of the annual report. I've got to say that was a stroke of genius that you guys came up with, and so I think it's a great deal. And it's something we've compiled research information regarding activities at the OHRC every year for years, but not in this format. And I think you'll see that there's a huge amount of work occurring at the Hatchery Research Center. I think it's a great source of information for your stakeholders, for all our stakeholders. I think that the board would be very interested in hearing your perspectives on the report and any suggestions you might have, since this is the first time they've issued one. If there are other things you would like to have seen, or more detail, less detail, that kind of stuff, I know they'd very much like to hear that kind of direction from you. I can say that the Hatchery Research Center has had substantial impact, and there are a number of different ways you might measure that, but I've just come from the American Fishery Society meeting, 50th anniversary meeting in Eugene, Oregon. They're meeting all this week, and I would guess that 10 or 15% of all the science being presented at that meeting is coming out of the Hatchery Research Center, so it is a substantial vehicle for at least scientific information. I think with that, I will just close my remarks. You're going to hear more and better stuff out of the folks behind us. And so that's probably the best role for me, to just shut my mouth. And
Well, thank you very, very much, Professor Edge. We certainly appreciate your appearance. Director Elicker, thank you for your opening statement about it is all about the fish. And I think that you're going to find that our committee is as dedicated to our natural resources as any fine group of people that you will find. And we're here to try and help the fish. So we want to be as helpful to your efforts as we can. We understand that the research may have not brought in the dollars that that we had hoped for. But I know that there are a number of us that are looking for some very precise information, and it would go a long ways in everybody needs something here, and we understand the financial needs that you all have, and folks like myself, I'm not a scientist, and we're probably going to have to make some calls here pretty soon in terms of, we have a room full of folks, as I look out, that enjoy fishing. And the fact that we have a lot of fish that are about to return is hopefully a good thing. But I'm also aware that we have lawsuits that have been filed to shut down a lot of the emphasis that we placed on hatchery stock. And so as a non-scientist, I am very challenged personally to be able to know how to make that call, because it is, as you stated, about the fish first, and we've got to make the right call. And we have a lot of Oregonians that are depending on us to make that right call. I don't have the information right now to make that call, and I'm going to rely on that hatchery center to provide me the information so I can make an informed decision, and an informed decision on behalf of all Oregonians and the fish. With that, I'd like to recognize Representative Krieger first and Representative Boone on deck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple comments, maybe a question. The main sponsors of the bill was the chair, myself, and Senator Robley. We have all received lots of adjectives about ourselves, but never the word genius.
Yeah.
That will definitely be in my next campaign. The vote on the bill, folks, in the two houses was 89-1, and the one vote was the guy that voted no on every bill that day because he didn't want to be here on Saturday. That was a real commitment to the research center, not to us. It was to the fish and the research center, and I think I want to make sure everybody understands that. I also made a commitment to Dr. Edge and you, your staff, that we would work diligently to find funding. We had our first meeting yesterday with basically everybody that has anything to do with salmon, you know, guides and packers, the steelheaders, you name it, CCA, everybody. And, of course, at first it's kind of rah, rah, rah. Well, at the end of an hour, we had the, well, yeah, if we understand where those dollars are going to go and it's going to help fish, we'll get them there. And then I had a conversation with you yesterday, Bruce McIntosh, Lindsay, about some of the ideas that we were looking at, and that needed to be separated from any possible fee increase the department has and will need in 15. And I'll commit myself to that. And then I'm having a meeting this afternoon with Mr. Brownscomb regarding the funding. I really believe that the state of Oregon wants to get back in the business of research. I think they're committed to it. This report is the first time that we've had help, some information that the public can understand what's going on. So you do have to sell your product. We're going to help you do that. We're going to get the dollars. I'll leave it there, Mr. Chair, but there was quite a commitment for this body, the legislature. And I don't want you not to take advantage of that momentum. Keep us educated, and we'll see what happens today.
Thank you, Representative Krieger. And as the director, his opening line, it's all about the fish.
Thank you, Representative Krieger, for that support. And we will be following up with that momentum. I personally want to ride the wave on this thing. If we can get some good research dollars and some research projects started and really sell that to the public, that is what we're here to do. So thank you very much.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Roy and Dr. Edge, welcome. Just so that I can answer and feel confident when I send my constituents of a certain fishery to look into this, can we be sure and assured that this group, this board, will work to maintain a purely scientific approach to things and not have, because there are people on this list who make me a little nervous as to where their allegiances are. So I just want to make sure that this is what we've asked for all along, is just the facts, just the science, and nobody's personal, you know, feelings about any particular type of fishery or things like that, because that's what's going to, I think, make it successful. And I think you get my drift. So. I hope you do.
It really wasn't a drift. It was pretty correct. Yeah.
That's a steelhead term.
Drift, yes.
So let me just say, Mr. Chair and Representative Boone, let me, a couple things come to mind. First of all, excellent question for the three members of the advisory board, since they're chair and vice chairs. But not to just push the question off on Cam, but, you know, let's face it, there's a lot of fishermen on the board, and we know fishermen. They like to go fishing and catch a lot of fish in their places, not necessarily in somebody else's places. So they all have their biases, is what I'm saying, just like we all do on these issues. But I think we've tried very hard to get a group that can work well together, and that really embraces some of the, when they come up and talk about the mission statement a little bit, I think that goes to the heart of your question. And I really, from the first three meetings we've had, and I've been at every one, as well as Dr. Edge, I would say in the end we've picked a good group that has a good sense of where they need to go and where they want to go on this issue.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
Representative Thompson.
Yeah, following Representative Boone, I realize it's all about the fish, but that's not what my constituents are complaining about. They're complaining about the fishing. Mm-hmm. And I'm getting a consistent roar from people that the fisheries in the lakes and streams has been depleted from what they remember it being. Now, I remember the good old days, too, and they were better than my memory. But I would suggest in pursuing this, and especially funding from the legislature, you put a singular focus on getting, and I'm an old researcher, getting fish into streams as part of your argument. I mean, we see the esoteric pure research reports that come out, something to the extent of, is peanut butter nutritional for trout or something like that. The public isn't going to buy that. The public wants to know that the work you're doing is going to increase the number of fish in streams, and they don't care if you buy them or raise them. You know, they want to take their grandkids fishing, and they're unhappy about that. So if you want public and legislative support, I would suggest that you try to focus what you're trying to do on an end game. And so everybody understands, I don't think you can sell pure research to the public right now. And I do get comments about ODF&W. They're things I wouldn't want to bring up in polite society. But yeah, and I'm sure you've heard them too. But when you're looking for someone to blame, hey, you're available, you know. And so we have to be sensitive to that when it comes time to funding, that what the devil are we funding ODF&W for? They caused the problem type theme, and look beyond that. But I think you have good support, but the public wants fish. And that's where we need to be focusing.
Point well taken, Representative Thompson.
Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My issue is that so often now there's litigation about just about anything, whether it's about fish or whether it's about owls or whether it's about other birds. There's going to be litigation in large part about the interactions of what we do with native species. And so I see the University of Washington spending a lot of time in trying to figure out this whole thing that we're talking about with respect to Puget Sound. They've got litigation going on up there. My concern is that every time I see litigation, the reports and the science they use is really old. We haven't got new science that repeats or substantiates the science that was done numbers of years ago. We know that our hatchery practices have changed, and so we're basing much of the information that judges have to make a decision on are based on the only science they have available to them. That was done at a time when we had hatchery practices that no one on this panel would agree were the right things to do. So we've made changes. We continue to improve every year, in my opinion. But we have no research to indicate that any of that stuff that we're doing has made any difference, because it's not going to be introduced into any court because there's no research that indicates that it has improved. And so I guess from the beginning of this research hatchery, when we first had the bill go through, it was our hopes that we would have those kinds of things happen, that we would start getting information that was current, that was replicable science, to answer some of the same questions that we know are going to show up in the courthouse. We know they are. They come every year. And there's no one, again, on this group that I know that wants to do damage to wild stocks or anything else. What we want to do is find out if there are ways to mitigate it. And when I first went to the fish hatchery, when it first opened, I had Dr. Noakes tell us that, given the time, we can put all the conditions here. We can produce anything we need to, genetically and otherwise. We can figure that out. And yet, I think we're here today because we want to figure out how. And I commit to you as well that when it comes to finding resources, I will do whatever I can to do that. I've had some conversations already. We just redid a trust to receive money that we could use in ocean research and other kind of stuff to work through OPAC and stuff. And I am committed to making sure that that includes how the fish that live in the ocean get there and get reproduced and so on. So if we can figure out how to get some money there to funnel through the STAC and OPAC to really have conversations to give them funding to this research, I'm committed to doing that. I mean, I have been committed for a while, and I recognize that we have not done justice, in my opinion, in Oregon to our natural resource agencies with respect to funding. So there is a commitment, I think, from a bunch of these people here to make sure that that happens. But it's difficult to go into a court if you are supporting the state, in their efforts. It's hard to go into court with reports that are decades old, when we have an opportunity to not do that. And I guess that's my statement is that's a commitment to you, and I hope that the commitment from Fish and Wildlife and from Oregon State University is to help find those kinds of research projects which would answer some of the questions that were being asked in court.
Chair, Representative, Senator Roblin, thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator. Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just Representative Thompson's talking about more fish in the stream is what people want. Of course, I think everybody wants that. But we have a controversy between hatchery and wild and what negative effect they might have. And, of course, the emphasis has been to do a couple of studies that identify what hatchery practices might be contributing to it. Because if we can identify that, then you have the ability to have a fish that is compatible more and not have those negative effects. And to me, that is the number one issue that we would like you to look at. And you've kind of addressed it in one of your three research projects to some degree. Maybe we should have a conversation with Dr. Noakes as to trying to understand what he needs and what we need and does this get to it all the way. But more fish, yeah. But the emphasis in the bill, if you look at it, from Jim Myron, Native Fish Society, what's the law say? In several different places besides this bill, it's about protecting native fish. Can we do that? I think we can do it. And I had a lot of conversations with Jim in my office. He came on board with the bill on helps. I know he'll be there for the research because he, if I think everybody recognizes we're going to have hatchery fish. Let's just develop a fish that's compatible, helps our economy, and yet at the same time protects our wild native fish. And if you work in that direction, I can't imagine that you're not going to get support for research and even the, you know, the public's perception of what you're doing.
Thank you very much. Anything additional? I would like to recommend Representative McEwen, did you have... I'm sorry.
I'm holding. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'd like to recognize Representative Reardon, please.
Thank you. Just a quick question from one that is not nearly genius and not as informed as a lot of these folks, but I've worked in manufacturing organizations, worked in schools, and at some point of the day, you usually get down to some kind of a measurable results. So I see a lot of mission and goals and good stuff in here. Is there some 2 or 3, 4, 5, 6 measures that could be plotted so that we actually know if we're accomplishing our goals in a way that would be easy to communicate to folks like me?
Mr. Chair, Representative Reardon, I think in the next report you will see more of what you're asking about, measurable results. You know, this report is just the result of a new board and 3 meetings. So it's a little skimpy on some things like measurable results, but I think in our next iteration here, the next report that we come to the legislature with, I will think you will see a more of an emphasis on that. So I want to make sure you're...
Yeah, sometimes my questions sound critical. It wasn't meant to be.
Sure.
It's just something I think it would be a good addition to it. So.
Thank you. Well, I'm going to make a note of that. Thank you.
Very good suggestion, good Representative Reardon. Representative Whitsitt, please.
Dr. Edge, I was wondering what role is modeling going to play in the basic science that you do at the hatchery?
Thank you, Chair. Representative Whitsitt, I'm probably not the best person to answer that question. Certainly, modeling is a primary component of many of the fields related to fisheries, many of the disciplines related to fisheries that some of our scientists use. I could imagine, for example, in the whole area of genetics, there's a lot of emphasis now on big data and modeling that comes out of that, simulation type of work, you know, the kind of evolutionary what-if kind of scenarios. But I would think that most of the work that we need to do at the Hatchery Research Center is more pragmatic and direct experimentation than modeling type of experiments.
Yeah, I would applaud you on that, and I would urge you to stick with empirical field-derived data and kind of lay off the modeling when you can. And as Senator Roblin said, make sure it's reproducible. I think that's the most important thing that you can do as a scientist, and you know that too, is to make sure that your data set is able to be reproduced time after time after time.
So. Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Yes, Representative McEwen, please.
Thank you, Chair Witt. I think I will take just a moment to weigh in. I'm really looking forward to hearing what your chair and your two co-chairs have to say about the direction that you're taking and get a little more into the details of that. But I think all of the comments that you've heard have covered a wide gambit of what our concerns and our interests are in moving forward with the Hatchery Research Center. But I think one thing I haven't heard expressed, I think, concisely is the fact that the issues that you're dealing with will have significant impact on the economies of our social, of our coastal communities. And I know that's not the scientific research that you're doing, but I hope it's not lost in the conversation that the decisions that are made and the directions that you take and the work that you do can have very important impacts on our struggling coastal communities. So it's something I hope we can continue to raise to a level of conversation.
Thank you. Gentlemen, with that, thank you very, very much. And thank you for the first steps towards addressing the needs that that we have expressed. This study is a great first step. We look forward to more depth in the future. That kind of empirical data that Representative Whitsett called your attention to, the potential audits that Representative Reardon would do, all of this would be exceedingly helpful to us as decision makers. And thank you for helping to accommodate our needs. We intend to be there for you, gentlemen. Thank you. A question for Chair Perry in terms of the flow of the presentation.
Yeah.
We have two scientists, Drs. Noakes and McIntosh, and, of course, then you all from the Research Center Board. Which makes more sense in terms of the flow of the presentation, the scientists first or the board members next?
We always like to save the best for last. So. We thought maybe we could start with the synopsis.
Very good. Please come forward.
Our science
committee. Please come forward. Welcome to our committee. Good morning to each of you. We recognize that you've traveled a considerable distance to get here. We appreciate that very, very much. We appreciate the opportunity to get to meet and hear from you firsthand. So thank you so very much for your appearance this morning. Welcome.
Well, thank you so much, Chairman Witt and Honorable Vice Chairs and members of the committee. It's an absolute honor for us to be here today in front of you. It struck me that it's not often that one gets to testify in front of a legislative committee about something very fishy going on in the state where everybody's happy to hear what they have to say. And this is an amazing day for us today to be here. I got up early this morning and I kind of flipped through the channels of the early morning TV and everything was murder and mayhem and gridlock in Washington. And I turned it off because I said, this isn't that kind of day. That isn't what this is about. This is a wonderful day. We have serious problems that we're facing with hatchery and wild fish, but the great thing about today is the beginning of solving those problems.
Excellent. Mr. Perry, thank you. Thank you very, very much. And while we know who you are, would you tell us for the record, please, sir, give us your name?
Oh, certainly. My name is Cam Perry, and I'm from Charleston, down in southern Oregon on the coast, and I've been involved in and around salmon and anadromous fisheries on the restoration side for about 30 years now. And I'll introduce my wonderful vice chairs, of course, Lindsay, our former ODFW director, involved in all things fishy for as long as anybody can remember. Very Don't good. Stand still long, or he'll get some money out of you for a fish project or get a commitment. And then Scott Starkey, of course, from Menasha Timber Products, and his company has been absolutely incredible. As a matter of fact, I'll brag on them a little bit. They won the Sportsman of the Year Award for their commitment to fisheries and wildlife this past weekend, which I was very proud of. I thought it was wonderful.
Thank you very, very much. And I think we might have a couple of members who want to say something here
just,
first.
Just
Representative
briefly,
Krieger.
Mr. Perry and his company, I believe, got an international award for a restoration project worldwide. I believe that's what it was, as the number one way of doing things in the proper way, and to have someone right in our communities that does that kind of work. We're fortunate to have him and, on the board.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you,
thank you very, very much. And I don't want to put them on the spot, but I don't know if Representative McEwen and perhaps Senator Roblin have anything to comment on here
yes,
as well.
I will take a moment if I have a chance. I'll let you know, we have two really outstanding members of our community that are sitting on this board and now in positions of power, and I have known them for most of the time that they've been in the community. Mr. Starkey had some exceptional children that went to Marshfield High School. And I've always said that you can usually tell the parent from their kids, and some parents don't want you to believe that, but the reality is pretty remarkable people that went to our school. And he has been a contributor and his corporation to our schools and our community, to fish in our community, for as long as the company's been around. And that's a 100-year-old company that's been around for a long time. So we really appreciate his willingness to volunteer and be here and to be a part of that. And with Cam is one of those people who lives right on the border. So our first member who spoke, Senator Krieger, he says Charleston, which Krieger has in his district, but the part of Charleston he lives in is across the bridge, so that's in my district.
Okay.
So it's kind of like...
Over on the mudflat.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right.
Across the mudflat. So you have to know the area to understand that Cam is right on the border for our two districts. And he has done some amazing things in the last few years. Went to a evening affair down in Bandon a little while ago about some of the efforts that they're doing, and we've got some other people that are doing some amazing things in and around Bandon, so... appreciate the efforts.
Thank you.
And before he ever got into it in our area, he was doing this stuff in other places. So
pretty good.
It's pretty exciting. And he has an exceptional wife.
that's the key to anything.
Know it and believe it.
Oh, thank you, McEwen. Chair Witt. And I would concur with what Senator Roblin has said. We're very lucky to have both of these gentlemen in our community. They are very well respected, very skilled, and bring the right combination of viewpoints with their expertise to this committee, and we couldn't be more delighted. And I believe, if I'm correct, that with redistricting, Mr. Starkey has moved outside of our district and is now Representative Krieger in Santa Cruz.
I wasn't going to mention that.
That's called a step up.
Took some wonderful people out of our district, and I'm very sorry about that, but delighted to have you here. Thank you for your willingness to serve. I know this takes a tremendous amount of time and effort on your parts, and I know that you think that this is important enough to rise to that level that you're willing to give of your time, and I could not be more grateful. So thank you.
Thank you so much.
And with that, gentlemen, I'm going to ask for your help here. There's so many accolades that we've run the clock, and part of my job as the chair is to make sure that we get things done on time, hopefully under budget. I've got about 15 minutes left to go for the entire presentation. So if you can capture the highlights for the committee, and we can get you and the scientists out of here by 9 o'clock, it would be exceedingly helpful. Thank you very much, and please proceed.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. We'll do our best to clip through this. I probably start out by answering some of the questions. I think one of the most wonderful things about this board and the science team we have and at ODFW is the diversity. We have tremendous strength and diversity. We have people who have been on both sides of lawsuits, which is not a bad thing in this case, and people who really understand the science and who are tremendous advocates for both wild fish and hatchery fish. And if the first three meetings are any indication, I think we've had some pretty outstanding results in setting a new direction as per your legislation and the philosophy of this board. And that philosophy, of course, echoes you, that our fish mean everything to us, and they deserve everything we can do to help them, to improve and enhance the runs and to protect our wild fish and to enhance our hatchery runs. And that's what we're going to set out to do. We rolled up our sleeves pretty quick because there's a lot of work to do, and there's a number of problems to address. And we had your legislation as our guideline, and we had the strong philosophy of this board moving forward as our guideline. And with that, we set to work, and we've set out an ambitious agenda for the coming year, which addresses some of Representative Reardon's questions. We thought that what we would do is take this direction and knock it down a piece at a time. We had a lot of homework to do, a lot of housekeeping. Dr. Noakes gave us the history of the world as it relates to science research at the Hatchery Center, the one-day version, and walked us through it. He will ask questions, though. It took me back to college physics classes, so you have to pay attention. We also did the review of the budget. We did our interagency agreement, of course, with Oregon State University. We reappointed unanimously Dr. Noakes as our director. We worked on developing our annual report, and we are working now in the middle of putting together an outreach group to address some of the other questions that we had. Lindsay is going to give you a little more in-depth on our mission statement, but I know as you have a chance to read through it, you'll see that it has changed to reflect the goals of the new board and the legislation. Just a couple of areas that are incredibly important to myself and the board is that we want to see
This research center helped facilitate and coordinate the on-the-ground efforts of groups and individuals that have a key interest in our fisheries and fish management. And that's a wonderful untapped resource out there in a big way. We have a citizen army standing ready to help us, and we'd like to be the catalyst that swings that into gear. We also want to make sure that the science that's developed here isn't just filed away in some boxes, but is used to create our management and policy as it affects our wild fish and our hatchery fish. And I know you guys have a tremendous commitment to that, too. The other thing that we did was we, of course, in addition to writing and revising our mission statement, we developed three key areas of science that we were going to focus on. And this board's a pretty pragmatic group. There's a lot of course, like you, this, you know, it's kind of neat that in our legislature, you can have your insurance agent also be your state rep. And it's much the same here, that we've all got different businesses. And we decided what's important. Let's focus on the three key areas that are most going to affect the lawsuits that Arnie talked about, so we can answer those questions, but help us move forward so we don't impact wild fish. So we developed three areas that we feel, and our science team feels, are very important to focus on, because they're going to go a long way towards solving questions. One is domestication. We have a problem with rapid domestication within a hatchery system, and we want to look at what can we do to avoid that. Representative Krieger and I have talked about this for years. How do we get to that point? Can we complex the rearing tanks and add some native woody debris? Can we put some rock in there? Will that give them more of a setting where we can raise a more pugnacious fish that has a better chance of returning? Do we raise them in too close quarters with too many fish? Is the competition affected? Does the times we feed these fish, will that affect it? The other thing that we want to look at, and this is critically important, especially when you get into managing so you don't impact our wild fish runs, and that's mate selection. And that's going to be discussed a little bit by Scott. But that is incredibly important. How do you raise the best, most vigorous fish that has the best chance of survival and the best opportunity for return? Because, you know, these salmon are amazing. You guys know. They pack more excitement, danger, and sheer force of nature survival into one day than most of us do in an entire lifetime. And if we can find a way to raise fish, whether that's with matching wild parents or wild hatchery parents or looking at generational matches, that's going to help us get a fish that has a better chance of return. Because we're talking about fish numbers earlier. We want to see more fish in our rivers. We want to improve on that 0.5% or less return in some of our river systems. And I think we can. The other thing is telemetry. And this is fascinating. Scott will give you a little bit more of a rundown on it. Fish can get lost out in the ocean. And there's not a lot of places where you can ask directions once you're out there lost. And what's amazing about our salmon and steelhead is they're born with like an internal GPS. But if we raise them in too much metal surrounding or rebar in their tanks, it can foul up that internal GPS and their connection to the Earth's magnetic poles. And that's, they lose their way. So if we can find a way to avoid that, and also the other thing we're looking at is well water. They can't home in on their native streams, so we're looking more at using pass-through water from the streams where they go to spawn. If we can solve some of these problems, we can start to eliminate the straying problems that are one of the biggest things we run into, of course, from the wild fish side and lawsuits, and also to keep that interaction from happening where we have problems with our hatchery and native fish. There's some wonderful things coming. Lindsay's going to give you a little bit of an overview on our mission statement, and Scott will do a little more of the science. Like Representative McEwen said, these fish mean everything to us. They're not just part of our economy in rural Oregon. Sometimes they are our economy, and it's incredibly important to us, and we are so blessed that you guys are all right there with us, and so is the legislature. And now I'd like to turn it over to Lindsay.
Well, thank you, Cam. My name is Lindsay Ball. I'm vice chair on the board. Chair Witt, members of the committee, and the Coastal Caucus, thank you for letting me be here with this opportunity. I have a long history with this facility, and I can tell you one thing I know for sure. When the legislative branch and the executive branch come together and start pulling together, good things are going to happen. And that's what's taking place here in this legislative assembly, and I appreciate that. It'll come on top. Not that I don't think it's done anything really bad, but we can enhance it and make it better. And funding is going to be part of the issue, not all of it, but certainly it'll help. With that, let's talk a little bit about the mission statement. 12 new people all came together. at meetings down at the Hatcher Research Center first, and since that time we've held them at the facility down at Corvallis, with the owned by the Department of Fish and Wildlife. Took us a little while to get to know each other, and then we started diving into the mission statement. I think it's good. You have it in front of you. We're running out of time, so I'm not going to read through it and discuss it in depth. But I do want to caution you. I think it answers and gives direction to what we've heard from the Legislative Assembly and also our fisheries scientists and the policy people within the agencies and at Oregon State University. We also have bounced this off of some of the interest groups, and they have not seen anything terrible wrong with it. Are there going to be some tweaks? Yes. Mission statements always change some. You're never going to write a perfect one. And as times change and issues change, your mission statement's going to change some. So be prepared for that. We'll make sure everyone gets notice that that's going to take place when it does, so everyone can have a review of it. With that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee and the Coastal Caucus, I think I'll step out of the presentation. And then if you have questions, I'm here to respond to them. And if you want to call me at home, send me letters and emails, that's fine. I answer that phone 24 hours a day. That started when Wayne's done the same thing, I know that, back in state police, and I still do it. So I can get a phone call anytime, and I'm going to answer.
Fantastic.
So don't be bashful.
Did we pass that telephone number around?
Lindsay, it's great having you back. Thank you so much. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you for the leadership of this committee and the Coastal Caucus in creating solutions to an issue that's pretty important to this state. And I also want to touch on one other thing. It is an economic boost to Oregon.
Amen to that.
Yes, it is.
Amen to that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Scott, welcome to our committee. If you would please introduce yourself for the record, and we're eager to hear what you have to say.
Okay, thank you. My name is Scott Starkey. I represent the forest products industry. I'd just like to make one comment in response to Representative Thompson. That you mentioned that, like, you have a lot of people who like to see things like the good old days.
Yeah.
Well, I've seen a lot of pictures of the good old days, even some for my family, were just stringers and stringers of fish. I often thought if they'd have put a few back, we might have more now.
That's right.
But the scientists have made three proposals to the board. Cam has gone through most of that, so I'm just going to summarize a little bit. But these three proposals we all think that are important to further understand the interaction between wild fish and hatchery fish. And the first one was a domestication study, which there's evidence that hatchery fish have reduced fitness in the wild reduced fitness in wild fish, and they have a fast genetic adaptation to hatcheries. And so the study proposed is to find out what hatchery conditions there are that cause this rapid adaptation. And Dr. Michael Bluen has proposed this study, and it's about $210,000 a year for 3 years is about what it is. There's more detail in your report. Mm-hmm. And I'm not the scientist, so Dr. Noakes can give you a lot more detail on this. The second one that Cam referred to is the salmon homing. We need to find out what causes straying, why some hatchery fish in some cases aren't coming back. And Dr. Noakes has proposed to study the chemical and magnetic imprinting to try to figure out how to bring those fish back and get them where we want them. And that study is about $104,000 per year for a 5-year study to conduct that. The third one Cam mentioned is the mate choice, and Dr. Michael Banks has proposed a study studying mate choice among coho salmon spawning in the wild, that there's evidence that salmon don't just salmon or anadromous fish don't just choose their mate randomly. There is some natural selection, and he's proposing to find out what gene combinations that might be take place in this mate selection that end up with a stronger, better, more fit fish. And that will help us better select the mate choice for the hatcheries to end up with a better fish coming out of the hatchery. So those are the three key proposals. We're certainly open to any other suggestions or prioritizing these, and Dr. Notes can provide a lot more detail. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Committee members, we're unfortunately very short on time, and I know some of you may have that burning question or comment. I want to allow it, but please keep it concise, Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This will be really fast. This is really great news, and I'm welcome, and thank you for doing what you're going to be doing and are doing. If there's any way that we can get regular updates, and I usually don't ask for emails, but more emails, but in this case I think we'd be interested, so that you don't have to get yarded into Coastal Caucus every month or whatever. Just send us, if it's your minutes or whatever you can, that would be great, or some sort of update that we could get.
We'd be thrilled to do that. It'd be wonderful to keep the conversation going constantly.
Chair Witt.
Yes,
we'd be happy to funnel that through the chair of the Coastal Caucus, and then we can disperse them, so you can just send it to my office.
I like going to Coastal Caucus. Do you guys have good food?
We'll have you in.
thank you.
We can manage that.
Thank you very, very much. I appreciate that. Vice Chair Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Has there been any management policy or management practice that's really come from exclusively conducting research at the facility? Is there anything that's come out in writing that we can bank on? We have a report here, but, I mean, do you have any set policy that's come out of here or any practice?
Yeah, that actually, Dr. Noakes, I think, would be wonderful to answer that. I mean, if you wouldn't mind.
We can do that. We'll call
him up here in just a minute.
Well, I mean, he can get back with me.
Okay.
It's fine.
Very good. Thank you. Senator Roblin.
I really love the mission statement. I enjoyed what I've just heard. I also hope that we continue to allow the facility to be used by Oregon State and graduate students to do their own little research, because I think that's been a positive thing for helping get the next generation of scientists. So I want us to focus on things, but I think that there are opportunities for this unique facility to be used, and I hope that that's part of the mission as well. I didn't necessarily see it, though.
Chair Witt, last comment for me. I just want to make sure that everyone recognizes the spirit behind the research hatchery when we build it was to answer questions just like what you see in our mission statement. It takes a little while to get going, but on the research. But I hope everyone recognizes it's the only one of its kind in the world. There isn't another research facility built like that, tailored to the detail that we're looking for.
Yep. And there has been a tremendous amount of adaptive management that's come out of this research. I mean, across the board, it's dazzling. That's why I wanted Dr. Noakes to talk about it a bit.
Very, very good. Gentlemen, Scott, go ahead.
Yeah, just one quick comment that you all know that salmon life cycle is like 3 to 5 years, so it's very difficult to do just a one-year study and learn much. You need to funding to carry that through long term in order to find out what we really need to know through these studies.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you so very, very much. You are a breath of fresh air. And the testimony that you've presented here this morning is as fine as this committee has heard. And we're going to place our faith in you. I think that you have taken to heart seriously the intentions of this committee with the legislation that we passed on to you, and it has every appearance that you're doing your very finest job to fulfill that. And I say thank you for your public service. Go do the right thing. Thank you very much.
Thank you also very much.
With that, I'd like to call up, please, Drs. Noakes and McIntosh. Welcome to our committee, gentlemen, and my apologies in advance of your testimony. If you can hit the highlights, it would be greatly appreciated. Welcome.
Good morning, Chair Witt, Vice Chairs, members of the committee, and members of the Coastal Caucus. For the record, Bruce McIntosh, Deputy Fish Division Administrator at the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and the department's representative on the board. In the sense of urgency, I'm going to defer to our director and let him deliver the news.
Thanks, Bruce.
Thank you.
Representative Witt, the chair, the vice chair, members of the committee, and from the Coastal Caucus in particular, I want to recognize and thank the Coastal Caucus for their support. Some of you may know, some of you may not know, that because of that support, the Oregon Coast STEM Center Hub, in fact, just has been notified they're getting $644,000 this year to support science teaching and science education in the coastal schools. And work is a big thing for us. My name is David Noakes. I'm a professor in fisheries and wildlife at Oregon State University and the director at the Oregon Hatchery Research Center. I'm pleased to be here to talk to people, to listen to people, and to answer questions you might have about the research activities, the plans for research, the history of research at the Research Center. You have the report in front of you. I don't want to take a lot of time to go through that unless people want me to. I can summarize some of the projects we're certainly working on, a number of things that answer questions that people have raised this morning, as well as some of the more basic research kinds of things. We're certainly working in response to questions brought to us by a number of groups, interest groups, stakeholders. We're working with the LC Steelhead Angler Group, for example, on a wild broodstock program that's of interest to us and of importance to them. Looking at some of the questions that other people have already mentioned, the projects, looking at some of the genetic effects, whether it's mate choice or domestication effects in hatcheries, and looking at the questions related to homing and straying. Both in terms of the chemical responses of the fish to the water they're raised in, which might seem odd, but probably, in fact, is quite important for hatchery operations, and then particularly the recent work they've been doing on geomagnetic orientation and navigation in salmon, which is a breakthrough in terms of the basic research, but it's also, I think, probably going to be very important in terms of hatchery practices, not just in terms of the hatchery itself, but also in terms of how we handle fish going through power dams, fish being transported in barges, fish maybe passing through coastal energy development areas and so on. So there's a number of projects we're doing. We've summarized here about 15 of those. The rule of thumb for doing research projects, it costs about $100,000 a year to run a research project, and so that works out to be about $1.6 million, which we estimate independently is the money we bring in to do research projects at the OHRC. We're particularly effective, I think, in terms of bringing in a lot of people, the key people in the field, and also people internationally. We bring in people from a lot of places at all levels, from undergraduate students to senior researchers who come here for meetings, who come for workshops, who come to collaborate in research projects. So I'm happy to answer questions you might have, take direction you might want to give us, or respond to questions.
Senator Roblin, Representative McEwen on deck.
I just want to make clear from my perspective that I really see this research hatchery as the scientific hub for all of our streams on the coast, because there's a lot of stuff we need to know about a lot of streams, and it's located in one place, and we can test things under good conditions, but there's a need to know a lot more about a lot of these other streams, and I hope that as time goes on, you'll look at all the other groups that are out there, volunteers and otherwise, that are trying to do good work to help us understand things, and you can be the hub to tell what kind of monitoring do we need to do over time so that we can have a broad enough amount of information to make some new science discussions on. I would love to see you guys help develop the protocols that let each of those do the things so that we can have a real sense that what they're doing is the same at each of those places so we can use it for scientific research. And I think there's a lot of, Oregon is noted for a lot of volunteer science that goes on out there, but it's really good when they've met with a scientist and they find out what protocols that they should do every time. We've done it with fishermen in the ocean. I think we need to do it in streams, and I think you guys are in a perfect position to do some of that. So I hope you can take on some of those kinds of issues as well.
Thank you, Senator and Chair.
Thank you very much. Representative McEwen.
Thank you, Chair Witt. I will be brief. Senator Roblin just raised the issue that I was going to touch on, which is research in the Hatchery Research Center is one thing, but how do we monitor our coastal streams to find out how that research is going to have an impact on what is actually going on out on the ground in all of our coastal rivers? So I think Senator Roblin just hit on it. What about the monitoring of the coastal streams?
Thank you, Representative McEwen. We have been involved in a number of those projects already. One of the first projects we did, in fact, was on the Clackamas River. Carl Schreck and I have done an extensive projects looking at fish in the Alsea and in the Nehalem. And other areas as well, and certainly it's of interest to us to do that. It does take a lot of resources to do that, and it also takes commitment from agencies and others to get involved in a monitoring kind of programs. And certainly it's generally true in most jurisdictions that I know of, most people are not very enthusiastic about getting involved in monitoring kinds of things because they see it as putting good money after good money, and you need to see some returns for that. And so I agree with the need for that. And I think we also want to make sure that we're proposing the right kinds of monitoring things rather than simply doing things because we've done it in the past.
Thank you very much. Representative Krieger, Boone on deck.
Just a couple quick ones. Dr. Noakes, there's always been the controversy between hatching wild and their reproductive success, specifically the steelhead. What is the difference in the reproductive success of wild steelhead compared to hatchery? You got the wild, you got the wild hatchery, and you got the hatchery. Can you give it? I think you know those figures. I just like to have them made part of a public record.
Thank you, Representative Krieger. Those studies have been done now. There's been about half a dozen studies done, some of them done by people working with us at the OHRC, not at the OHRC, but working through us, people like Professor Bluen and others. And Mike Bluen, in fact, is just finishing a major review of that, looking at all the studies that come out that are relevant to that. And the answer is quite consistent. In fact, his data suggests somewhat higher levels than the other studies do. And it looks like, in fact, there's about a 30 to 40% reduction in reproductive fitness of fish taken on average across those conditions. Reproductive fitness being the number of offspring that are produced by the mating of fish from a particular parentage. Hatchery fish in general don't do as well when they're reproducing the wild compared to wild fish or compared to crosses of hatchery and wild fish. And so that appears to be a consistent pattern in a number of studies across a number of jurisdictions.
Please.
Bruce, I was reading on page 27 of the report, there's been about 50 projects. Do you know any specific thing that's come out of those projects or science that you've taken and then applied into our hatchery system today?
Chair Whip, Representative Krieger, there's a number of things directly related to this issue of hatchery wild. We've been working around the fringes because we're really on the edge of getting those results. I'd say one of the clearest examples not related to this is how do we raise triploid trout? So triploid trout are raised so that they're sterile and then we can put them into lakes and systems and then they don't interact with wild fish. And through the work that David and his folks did there, we came up with a technique to do that consistently and apply it out in the ground, and now that's the practice within our hatcheries. So there's a direct example. In terms of the hatchery wild stuff with salmon, we're still working on the edges of that, and the work we're proposing really takes us those next steps.
I'd like to follow up with him later. Also, regarding monitoring, yesterday we talked about it. You said you would get together with Mr. Starkey and the board members and discuss the issue.
Absolutely.
I hope that you do that.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Noakes, thanks for coming today, too, and Dr. McNamara. You mentioned, I think, you're working on some studies around potential impacts on ocean energy projects. And I just wondered, do you work with NEMRAC, or are they independent studies for the device developers, or how are you connected there? No pun intended.
Thanks for your question, Representative Boone and Chair. The answer to your question is yes and possibly. The research we've done, in fact, was not directed towards questions about ocean or nearshore energy development or those kinds of things. It was really directed toward a question of homing and string because it came out of a research workshop we did to try and understand what the mechanism might be. Because of the work of one of the postdocs that I've hired on that project, we now know that, in fact, the story is true. The question is whether it's important. So we know that, in fact, salmon and steelhead can detect very weak electromagnetic fields. They can detect and respond to changes in those, and disruptions of the normal geomagnetic field, in fact, disturb the fish quite significantly. One of the obvious questions, then, is how is that related to coastal energy development, deployment, undersea cables, and so on? And so it's a question that's arisen out of that research, and the answer is we don't know. I've contacted the people you've mentioned and do not yet have a response from them. But we'll certainly follow up on it. Thanks, Representative and Chair.
Gentlemen, thank you very, very much. Our apologies for such an abbreviated questioning period, but we certainly appreciate the research that you're doing and the fact that what you're doing is helping not only the board but this committee as well. Thank you very much. With that, I'm going to...
One brief...
Yes, please, Representative
McEwen. Thank you, Chair Witt. We had a conversation yesterday at Coastal Caucus, and we will be contacting you to set up a field trip. So we would all like to come and have a chance to take a look at what's going on. So we'll be on your radar soon.
looking very much forward to coming.
Would that include those outside the Coastal Caucus?
We hadn't thought about that, but I see no reason why we couldn't expand our group.
And fresh fish dinner, I think, with that or something. So, with that, I'm going to thank you, gentlemen, very, very much. Close the informational meeting on the Oregon Hatchery Research Center and open an informational meeting on the unmanned aerial systems. Thank you all very much. I recognize that some members have other places to go. Thank you very much. I'd like to ask that Jeff Lorton bring up whatever panel he would like to have come forward at this point.
Hi, can you hear me okay, Robert?
Yes.
I love your presentation. Thank you very much. The guys are just going to come in here.
Okay.
Let's wait until for a second.
Yes.
Aviation is good for me, too. Judiciary gets these bills. Are you going back to that?
I think they'd have a little bit flying around in here.
Oh, thank you. Hey,
really great to see you.
I don't know, 3-4 years, something like that. Right?
So I'd like to thank very much the committee for inviting us today. We have a really, really great group of people here to speak to you on this on the issue of unmanned aerial systems and agriculture. I'd like to introduce them, and then I'm going to sit down and I'm going to back clean up today if there's time. So the first person I'd like to introduce you to is Mark Morrison. Mark Morrison is the executive director of the newly formed Oregon Unmanned Aerial Systems Business Enterprise, which is, he's got some news on a renaming of that organization. Mr. Eric Simpkins is the business development officer for the Near Space Corporation in Tillamook, which is the operator of the Tillamook Unmanned Aerial Systems Test Range, recently designated by the FAA. This is Mr. Ryan Jensen. Mr. Ryan Jensen is the CEO of Honeycomb Corp. In addition to being a NASA scientist for many years, he's now an entrepreneur in the field of unmanned aerial systems and is based here in Oregon. And then Mr. Jonathan Evans is the CEO of Rising Tide Innovations. He's also the board member and representative of the AUBSI Cascade Chapter, which is a national organization for unmanned systems. And then, of course, you should recognize Director Swickert, who's from the Department of Aviation. My name's Jeff Lorton. I'm the lowest guy on the totem pole here. I'm the economic development guy for Yamhill County, and I'll speak last. Thank you very much. With that, Mr. Morrison will start.
Thank you very much, Jeff, very much. And if you would, before you begin your testimony, please state your name for the record. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you.
We're so fortunate to have such a distinguished panel. Please proceed.
Chairman Witt, members of the committee, my name is Mark Morrison. I'm the executive director of the Oregon UAS Business Enterprise. I've been in that position for about 4 weeks. My job is purely and simply an economic development job. I am measured on jobs created, payroll, and economic impact for the state of Oregon. In my prior lives, I've been a venture capitalist, an investor, a senior executive of manufacturing companies, and one of the reasons that I've been very excited to take this position is at the birth of an economic and industrial ecosystem, there's a lot of opportunity that can be captured by the first movers. One of the first things that we did at Oregon UAS Business Enterprise was to issue an RFP. The goal of this RFP is to solicit as many UAS-related projects in as broad a fashion as possible. The time on the RFP closes tomorrow night at midnight, and I can tell you one of the things that surprised me as somebody who's a relatively new entrant to the field of UAS is the geographic diversity of the interests, ranging from the south of Oregon and up into the northeast corner in Pendleton and across an extraordinarily broad ecosystem. Everything from propulsion systems to precision manufacturing to software to mapping to agriculture-related projects. I trust all the telephone calls and emails translate into projects that I get to consider. Within the RFP, our lead-off ask was for projects within precision agriculture. And for the members of this committee, you'll realize that on a national basis, precision agriculture has been identified by a number of sources as one of the largest growth opportunities within UAS. I'm going to leave you with a little packet of information, which includes the RFP, so you don't have to go online to see it, a couple of pages of summary of our implementation plan at Oregon UAS Business Enterprise to see how we will tackle the business of stimulating jobs and industry development and recruitment within the state of Oregon. It also includes a listing of our board of directors, and that's a pretty impressive listing by my view. It covers academia, it covers civic leaders, it covers industry leaders. There are 14 people on that, and I think you'll be pretty impressed that it's not just a very narrow focus, but a group that are both passionately committed and very, very qualified for bringing about our mission. With that, Chair Witt, members of the committee, I'd like to close my introductory remarks.
Thank you very, very much. Who's next?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Eric Simpkins. I'm Business Development Manager for Nearspace Corporation. We're a Tillamook company. And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for your invitation here today. I appreciate it. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate you attending UAS Day yesterday.
Absolutely.
You were there for quite a long time. I want to give you a little background on unmanned aircraft systems and the contribution that the state of Oregon and the organizations within the state will be making to the industry. How do we advance slides?
AV?
How do we show slides? Do you have
We monitors? Have help is on the way.
Help is on the way.
We can just use the arrow.
Okay, very good. Yep. Thank you, ma'am. Okay, so the U.S. Congress a couple of years ago mandated that the Federal Aviation Administration would find a way to integrate unmanned systems into the national airspace, as I'm sure you're aware. And it was decided by the FAA that they would establish 6 test sites to conduct this research across the United States. That was a competitive process, and last December, according to their schedule, they announced the 6 awardees. State of Oregon teamed with the state of Alaska and the state of Hawaii to compete for one of those 6 sites. And because of the diversity of the geography, the climate, and the participants that we were able to offer the FAA, we were selected as one of those 6 test sites. That gives us an incredible jump.
Yes.
Across the spectrum of participants in the UAS industry in our country. We're also the very largest test site. We also received the highest score from the FAA, so we're very proud of our proposal accomplishment. I'll give you an example of a UAS application in agriculture, and I'll talk a little bit about privacy, which is a matter of interest. First of all, nomenclature. We prefer the term unmanned aircraft system rather than unmanned aerial vehicle or drone. Drone implies things that shoot, and we don't do that in Oregon. And they range in size from the Predator, which is a very large vehicle, about a 55-foot wingspan, but a $4 million creature, to something you can buy on the on Amazon. We were told yesterday that about a 1,000 small UAV UASs were sold on Amazon per week, which kind of puts a lot of hardware into the national airspace. And there are systems now the size of your thumb, very, very small unmanned systems. The goal of the FAA process is to integrate these vehicles into the national airspace system. They spell that SAFE, S-A-F-E. And their objective is to conduct the research at these 6 test sites that will permit them to develop an additional set of regulations, very similar to what we use for manned systems in this country, that would apply to unmanned integration. The test site award was made to our 3-state organization. It's called the Pan-Pacific UAS Test Range Complex. So envision an umbrella of the 3 states called the test site, and within that test site system, there are 13 specific test ranges where we'll conduct this research. Three of those ranges are in Oregon, located at Tillamook on the coast, at the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs, and at the Eastern Regional Airport System at Pendleton. We have one reserved at a Air National Guard testing station in the Christmas Valley area. The three test sites have 180 days from January to become active, submit applications to the FAA to become operational and actually conduct our first flights. And we'll meet that. We'll be doing our first flight within the next 60 days out in Tillamook. In fact, we've done UAS flights in Tillamook for quite some time, along with some very large balloon systems. This is one of the smaller balloon systems we operate, but what its job is to drag a small unmanned aircraft system, which we call a shuttle, up to a very high altitude and then drop it and allow that unmanned system to, either in powered flight or an unpowered flight, glide back down to the Earth and conduct its mission. One of our missions right now is to examine the next generation of technology that the FAA will be using for tracking aircraft through the airspace system, and this uses a GPS satellite system rather than ground-based radars. And so we're taking components to that new satellite system technology, taking it up to very high altitude and then seeing how it operates as we would fly manned aircraft from the edge of space all the way down to ground level again. Today, across the United States, the UAS is about an $11 billion market, and it's expected to increase many times. We all see the hockey stick curves. I'm not so sure I believe a lot of those curves, so I'm not going to give projections. But it is about an $11 billion market today. There are a little over 90 firms in Oregon who contribute to the UAS industry, from companies that build the unmanned vehicles to software developers to guys who grind out precision machine parts for those systems. It's worth about 1,400 jobs and $120 million impact to payroll, creating about $225 million in total economic benefit to the state within the next 3 years. So we're a rapidly growing segment of the aviation industry and perhaps the only real growth segment of the aviation industry. We are required by the FAA to embrace the business of privacy, and what the FAA requires the six test sites to do is to adopt a privacy policy, which will probably be standard across the United States, a set of implementing procedures. And one component of that is to retain data for a certain known set of time to protect that data, and much of this will be IP because this is essentially a research project, to protect that data and to conduct annual meetings with the public to get public input that would be used to potentially update our policies and procedures regarding privacy. We will act in accordance with all the existing laws that protect both people and property as we conduct our operations. And there's a very healthy set of laws, as we all know. Unmanned systems are used throughout the world, not so much in the United States as in so many other countries. Because of our safest air system in the U.S., we have a lot of regulations, and one of those regulations is we don't fly unmanned systems today in the National Airspace System above 400 feet. There are some criteria that allow us to fly above 400 feet and conduct some preliminary research, and that's done in Oregon as well. But the designation of the FAA test site allows us to expand that effort significantly. If we had had an unmanned system when Katrina hit the Gulf Coast, we could have prevented the loss of communications that occurred throughout that entire region. We could have done what the military does, which is establish a communication command post in the sky. And first responders would have had communication and been able to conduct their services with all the comm services that they're accustomed to, instead of what happened. I'd like to talk now about an agricultural application for unmanned systems, and we're starting to do this in Oregon, and we will expand this very significantly. In fact, most of the UAS applications globally are for agriculture applications and what they call precision agriculture, and I'll explain what that means in a minute. But the background is to think a little unconventionally. We need to produce 70% more food to serve the population growth of the planet by 2050. The U.S. will contribute a lot to that, but all crops and all producers across the globe suffer from disease and pests, and we lose almost 25% of our crop yield due to those disease and pest issues. So how can UAS help? Well, we have to understand first that for a plant to be sick, three things have to be present. There has to be a pathogen, there has to be a host plant, and there has to be a conducive environment. And UAS can help because we can detect some of the impacts of these things. I'll refer you to the picture here. On the upper left-hand corner is a standard black and white photo taken by a fixed-wing aircraft today. Really doesn't tell us much about what's going on with that crop. The picture to the right, the two pictures to the right show areas that are dry in that farmer's field, and the picture in the bottom shows an area that's wet. So the farmer, instead of just turning on the timer and watering his field to an established sequence of watering operations, can now water portions of his crop knowing what's dry and what isn't. That applies to the applications of pesticides and herbicides, applies to the application of fertilizers. Also, it allows the farmer to be able to see the early signs of disease. If you look at a picture on the left-hand side, normal color photograph taken from a fixed-wing aircraft. The picture on the right-hand side is taken as a spectral image taken in the same altitude from an unmanned aircraft system using a hyperspectral technology that allows us to see the first signs of stress in this particular orchard. And what's happened here is that the farmer has started to see on those yellow and red orchard trees in the upper right-hand corner, he's starting to see signs of disease, a stress on the plant. But if you went out and walked the field, you wouldn't be able to see that. So spectrally, we're able to see this from the air and give that farmer about a six-day jump on what any other farmer would be able to see by walking his fields. With that six-day jump, he can get an attack. He can mount an attack on that disease, and perhaps save not only the entire crop, but certainly those focused plants. So UAS has a lot of application in agriculture. Has a lot of application throughout our country in a number of ways. In Tillamook, we're starting UAS operations with Oregon State University to
Representative McEwen.
Yes. I'm sorry to stop you. This intrigues me greatly. Without going into too much detail, can you tell me of those 9 trees, those 10 trees that are starting to be stressed, mm-hmm. what are we seeing? Are we seeing a temperature variation? Are we seeing the beginnings of a color variation in the leaves? What are we seeing?
You're seeing a stress on the leaf that isn't obvious to the human eye, but we can see it in a different frequency of light.
So it is a color variation that we're seeing.
It's the sign of cellular damage within the leaf of the plant is what we're starting to see. And it starts out very subtly, and these plants have gotten to, you know, a fairly advanced stage, but still early enough that the farmer can react to it and save those orchard plants.
Representative Whitsitt.
What are your X and Y axes? What are they? They aren't identified other than numerically.
Temperature.
What? No. We're trying to...
Oh, I don't know what the X and Y axes represent in this case. They're probably figures of distance would be my guess.
Okay.
But I don't know specifically. Sorry.
Thank you.
A lot of applications for unmanned systems, and thank you for your time. I appreciate any questions. Be happy to field them.
Certainly appreciate that very, very much, Mr. Jensen.
Thank you.
I don't know if that's going to work out too well.
Just tell me I'll push it.
Okay. Let's advance to the next slide. There we go.
Chairman Witt, members of the committee, thanks for allowing me to speak here. My name is Ryan Jensen. I'm CEO at Honeycomb Corporation, which is a company that develops UAS for precision agriculture. So that question that you have, I'll actually cover that in a sec here. So a little bit about my background. I actually recognize a few of you. I testified with the Oregon University system about the importance of research several months ago. I was the 19-year-old graduate who did some NASA work and all that, so that's kind of where I come from. Now I have a company that is in the process of development for UAS systems for precision agriculture. And I really want to emphasize in my talk the importance of this space, the growth of this space, what the possibilities are, because I look at it as a very disruptive technology with a huge potential. So I'll jump to the next slide. So there's a variety of systems. So you can think of the UAS as flying robots. That's how we look at it. We look at it as flying robots with sensors or that perform work. And that's really the fundamental thought behind them. And so what you can do is you can deploy these rapidly. You can deploy these in places and in applications that don't seem completely obvious. And up there you see, fixed-wing platforms that are deployed by hand or that land on the belly or that are conventional or that are multi-rotor or that are helicopter. And so in that picture there, you see just the different variety of platforms. With the fixed wing, you're able to cover more area. A conventional plane, you can go faster, cover more area. With the multi-rotors, you can hover, you can look at things closely. So there's a variety of different ways that you can use these platforms depending on which one you're using. And so for our system that we develop, it's a fixed wing, that first one you saw on the first slide. It flies over crops. It images in the visible spectrum, so what you see normally with your eye. In the multispectral, so what you were talking about there was what's happening is you have the photosynthetic process, and plants absorb light in particular frequencies and emit light in particular frequencies. And so when they're stressed, the photosynthetic process changes, so the near-infrared emission changes. Okay. And so what we're doing is we're taking that ratio, and that shows you what's going on. So you can't see that with your naked eye because people can't see in the near-infrared, but the cameras can. And that's multispectral. You can also look at a whole range of the spectrum. There's also hyperspectral, which I'll talk a little bit about. But the main thought is that you have these flying robots. Go ahead.
Vice Chair Frederick.
Thank you.
Sorry.
You move back from the mic a bit. You don't need to be right up
on
top
sorry.
Of it. Thank you.
So you have the platform, you have the sensors. There's a variety of sensors that you can put on there. Right now, people are focused on imaging type sensors, multispectral, thermal, hyperspectral LIDAR, but those are the variety of sensors that you can put on these platforms, and we'll advance to the next slide. And so here's some maps of what can be produced. In the top left, you see a prescription map using NDVI, so that's looking at the stress of that crop, and you can see that there's areas that are more stressed than others, and you can actually use that information to decide how much nitrogen to put in those particular places, because that's indicating the vigor. So the green is a vigorous portion, and the red is a less vigorous portion. We've done some tests with some farmers as far as looking at damage assessment. So if you have a crop that's damaged for some reason, it's going to be stressed. You can pick that up with NDVI. You can do the image processing, and you can say this is the damaged portion, or this is the part that's stressed. And that middle picture, the top middle, what actually happened there is some cows got in the field, and they ate some crop, and you can see that, and we can actually measure that exactly. So instead of saying it was this much is a damage, you can say it's this many acres exactly. We also have in the top right there, we did some analysis for a farmer, and they had an irrigation line break, and they didn't know the extent of the damage, and we were able to look, and you can see a much bigger stressed area than they thought. Bottom left is a rendition of LIDAR, so it's a topography. So if you take a bunch of images, just normal visible images, you can create a 3D reconstruction of that terrain. You can also put LIDAR on where you can get an extremely accurate indication of the terrain or even inventory for forestry. So we have two projects going on with OSU, which is looking at wheat and looking at forest land. And so the idea with wheat is, okay, let's fly over this at a high frequency and see problems as they occur or detect problems as they occur. And in forestry, it's let's fly over these and look at, you know, what kind of inventory can we measure just using visible imagery and compare that to what's on the ground. So those are the two applications that we're working with that involve agriculture and forestry. And going to the bottom middle is a thermal image of a pivot. So one of the sprinklers is out, one of the nozzles is out, clogged, and you can pick that up with thermal. And in California, for example, or even here or wherever, water is a big issue, and thermal allows you to see where you have differences in evaporation. So if you have puddles or pooling, or you have a sprinkler out, you're going to have a different temperature wherever there's water, wherever there's transpiration, because that's a phase change process. And so you can see that, and you can manage better knowing that information. And a key aspect of the UAS is you can do that monitoring whenever you want it, extremely frequently. So instead of waiting, you know, a couple weeks or a month for a satellite, or even waiting a week or more for a plane that's going to cost a lot to mobilize and so forth, these can be deployed instantly. So you can get that information when you want it. And if you're, you know, familiar with farming, then it's a high monitoring situation. You need to know what's going on. You need to be able to manage. You need to be able to figure out what to do. And what we've heard over and over and over is we need information, and we need it quickly, and we want to be able to make decisions. And these platforms that are flying sensors, and you've probably heard a lot about sensors in the field, just these are sensors that move in the field. And you can put them wherever you want in space, and you can get that information. You can pump it up to the cloud, which is how we get our information. We can process that. And the information stack or the technology stack that's involved is very diverse. It's avionics, it's airframes, it's imaging, it's sensors, it's software. And so there's a lot of possibility for, awesome job growth. I mean, cool engineering. It's really one of those things. When we look at it from our perspective as, you know, this is a PC. What kind of apps can you build on top of it? You know, it really is that disruptive, if you will. And in the bottom right, we just have one last image of some compliance measurements. So we were able to measure particular aspects of the field for compliance. We're able to measure things as well as buffer zones, you know, measuring the distance between an organic or non-organic field, again, because you can get that imagery when you want it. Next slide. And sorry, jumped on the his slides. But that's kind of the idea that I really want to convey, is that there's huge applications in agriculture that are unlocked with this technology. And as this industry develops and more use cases are found and more users are a part of this, you're going to generate data. And it's going to be an information play, coupled with hardware, coupled with robotics, coupled with composites, manufacturing, all sorts of things. And, you know, as Eric was mentioning, Oregon has this opportunity. We have this, you know, six test proposals were chosen. You know, we're part of the University of Alaska, one, and we have three sites here. I mean, it's a huge opportunity to develop hubs of innovation with a very diverse technology stack and high-paying jobs, very interesting technology, very much in a very rapidly emerging market as well. So just really want to emphasize that. And with that, I'll thank you for your time.
Thank you very, very much. Questions or comments for Mr. Morrison, Simpkins, or Jensen? Mr. Jensen, I'm just curious what we could be doing as a state to help promote the expansion of this industry. And I suspect one is simply a matter of public knowledge. How would we create or help to create career paths for students who might be interested in this kind of field?
Yeah, that's a great question. We found, I've been in Pendleton, I've been in lots of different places, I've been in North Dakota, I've been in California, and there's Kansas State. There's lots of places who have been leading kind of the education aspect, the workforce aspect. I think OSU has been doing quite a bit of that. It's probably been the leader in Oregon, at least. But I think encouraging that, and then, really, it does come down to funding as well. I mean, this is an emerging market, so supporting these test sites is huge. And allowing that seed to grow will attract lots of talent, attract people from all around, and that creates this this nexus where you're able to build from that. And like I said, it's emerging. There are a few players out there. I think in Pendleton, the community college is working to implement a program for UAS, you know, technicians, service providers, and software. But I think supporting these sites and supporting the development is key right now. It really is.
Thank you. Representative Reardon.
Thank you. Just a question. I think this is really exciting. I mean, just amazing what you can do and has amazing potential. But there's always something to worry about, right? So in the future, do you see this being used for application of pesticides? And if so, how accurately can you control that? Do you have a good data set for mapping? And, you know, it's got to be better than my cousin Butch in his airplane. I know that.
So there's three aspects to this. There's the detect the problem, diagnose the problem, and manage the problem. And part of the management aspect includes aerial application of pesticides. So the Japanese have been doing this for 30 years or so. Their system is RC that they use over there. They use it on rice paddies. I believe it's Honda that puts out that system, but there's several companies actually in the U.S. that we've been in contact with who do the same thing. But and the University of California, Davis, is doing a lot of work. So, yes, there is a place for aerial application, and that could actually be fixed wing or helicopter. And the idea is to get the good maps with the information, right? Map this out, figure out where the problem is, get a consultant in the loop, and then say, okay, here's the issues. Let's implement a management procedure. And that may include UAS, or it may include, you know, putting that into a variable rate technology and a tractor on the ground, or it may include eventually a crop fixed wing crop sprayer. It may be that as well. That's a UAS. But there are actually people working on each component of that, the imaging and the application.
And Representative Reardon, I think some members of the next panel are going to speak specifically to your question, and it's quite amazing.
Okay. I'll be patient.
Did you have another question?
I'll wait.
All right. Thank you. Yes,
just
Senator.
A quick one. Last session, we had a number of bills come to Judiciary with regard to how to start imposing restrictions and whatever on UAVs. We narrowed that down to just one that had to do with police and so on, public people. I understand Hawaii has a number of them right now. So any insight you have into how we allow your business, your plans to grow and not get too over-engaged from the requirement of imposing restrictions on them based on legislation. Any ideas?
Yeah, thank you, Senator. There was one piece of legislation that passed through and was signed by the governor, H.R. 2710, begun by Representative Huffman and modified significantly in Senate Judiciary last year. That piece of legislation ended up a good piece of legislation. I think law enforcement, and I know of number of people in the sheriff's office and municipal police departments who have commented to me about that bill, and they say that doesn't restrict them in any way other than what is probably the appropriate way.
Right.
That said, there's a couple of kind of goofy things in it that say that if you, for example, if you fly over a private property owner's land a second time, you have to get his permission to do it. You're free. You get a pass on the first time. The second time, you have to get permission. You have to fly at a certain altitude, which is very hard to verify as a ground observer. There's a couple of things in it that we can probably improve, but it does not harm the industry, and it does allow the industry to grow. And to Chairman Witt's point, education on your side of the fence is equally important, such that we don't inhibit this industry, but that we do manage the protection of people's privacy and property.
And it is my understanding that you have big requirements from the FAA on privacy and making sure that they're part of this whole study that's going on.
We absolutely do. Absolutely. Yep.
Gentlemen, thank you so very, very much. What a absolutely intriguing industry this is. Jeff, you want to bring up the next panel?
Yes, that's the problem.
Why don't you sit on that right there?
correct? I believe the director will not be able to. He has another meeting he has to go to.
Okay. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you very much. I'll leave it to Jonathan to start, and I'll follow.
Okay.
Yeah, I guess there's two slides for me?
Yeah. There's two slides for Jonathan.
Jonathan, if you please introduce yourself to the committee, welcome.
Thank you, Chairman Witt and members of the committee. This is my second day in the building. I got to do the UAV today yesterday and give a briefing to Representative Witt and others, and I'm just a little excited to testify to my first legislature. So my name is Jonathan Evans.
Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Jonathan Evans. I was previously a Black Hawk pilot in the United States Army for 9 years, and then I've also been an entrepreneur and most recently an EMS pilot for Life Flight at the various 12 bases that we have in the region, mainly out of Eugene. And that's what brought me to the unmanned space. Is I was sitting there reading the internet in Eugene, and I think I got to the bottom of it a few times on this subject and scratched it and said, wow, okay, it's time to hop out of the cockpit and into business now. So RTI, Rising Tide Innovations, is based in Portland. We're angel-backed. We're actually recently backed by one of the founders of Skype, which is just a huge accomplishment in itself because that guy's really smart, and he's added a lot to what we're doing. We're actually providing a cloud-based system that Ryan was actually referring to provide these farmers direct access to this market. We see basically the global network of unmanned systems as being a physical extension of the internet, and I think Ryan puts it well to call it aerial robotics. This is the information network reaching out into the real world in real time and in ubiquitous 3D space, and being able to tell us new information about it. Is these gentlemen have done an excellent job of showing you in great detail here. Part of my job here today as a board member of AUVSI is to promote this technology. It's to help normalize the technology for the public imagination. And yes, to start to diminish the effects of our charming brand ambassador in my alma mater of the military for this technology. Aviation itself started in the military. The internet started in the military. And both arrived to become commercialized and, I'd say, even democratized. And that's what we see the aerial perspective on the drone network, the UAS network, becoming as well. You'll see why I stumble on that word very soon. the press and public have given us the word. And I think that it'd be hard to call it a Lindbergh moment, but Jeff Bezos has done a real good job of normalizing the term for us. And what I think our job is now is to inspire a new creative imagination in the public mind for what the word means. And so what I'm here to introduce you to is what we're doing at AUVSI, and we're centering it right here in the Silicon Sky of the Oregon region, Portland and Oregon region. That peculiar and interesting nexus of aviation heritage as anchored by Evergreen, Columbia Helicopters, HTS, and then Boeing and Insitu, and then Intel and Tektronix and all of the computer architecture that sits here, I think is what causes this region to be peculiarly focused on this technology. And we have a real opportunity to be the hub of this innovative new tech corridor centered on these test sites. So what we have done is chosen a regulatory vehicle that allows the proponents of the technology to start celebrating it and telling their story. And we call it Drone Prize. It's a national contest. Will it go straight to the video?
It will go.
Oh, okay, yes. So droneprize.com. It's a national contest that is soliciting enthusiasts and hobbyists, the ones that are buying those 1,000 quadcopters a week on Amazon, to go out and engage the public good with their hobby. And the regulatory vehicle here is that below 400 feet within line of sight operations, the FAA advises that that's okay for radio-controlled hobbyists to fly these things still. The biggest distinction in a legal environment is that they can't do it for commercial operations. So we offer them a contest, a public, a recreational vehicle, if you will, to go out and meet their fire departments, to meet their park managers, to meet their academics and their teachers and those in STEM education in the high school systems, and engage their community and upload a video of the mission that they accomplished and go ahead and celebrate the technology, tell these good stories, and then point it all back here to the Silicon Sky in Oregon, where we're going to have the finals this summer in late August. And we're going to run our three finalists through a set of scenarios that we've already worked in demonstration down in the Eugene Fire Service. We'll have them run real-life scenarios with real first responders in doing probably like an earthquake kind of scenario where there'd be multi-agencies that could benefit from having the aerial perspective, a lot like Eric was putting up there for Katrina. And we're going to also hopefully highlight at least one of these test ranges during the finals and have an awards event basically in Portland so that we can have a national press event to celebrate this technology. And I'd just like to show you our intro video that was put together with a help of about eight folks on the committee that I'm running for AUVSI. I guess we could probably how about that?
Oh yeah, there it is right there.
Yep. And here is, this should speak for itself if we did it correctly.
I think we have to press.
Is there sound, dude? Okay, good.
You might want to press it again.
They press it again, yeah.
Oh, sorry about that.
Quick time not available. Mm-hmm. Oh, dear.
Does this system not play video?
Yeah, it usually does.
You can pull up
the website. Oh, well. Yeah, can you pull up the website directly? It's right there at the...
Okay, let's do that. Sure. How do we get to escape? Great.
And
okay.
The downsize this?
Okay.
There
we go.
So,
DronePrize? Oh, yeah, DronePrize.com. And just to answer your question, Senator, I had an answer too, real briefly. I would say that what I come to, if I was sitting on your side of this, is we've encouraged you to continue to legislate behavior with the technology. For example, search warrants. It's an appropriate article of our social contract that this technology definitely requires a conversation about, as wiretapping did before. As any new technology will, we have to analyze that social contract. But we would encourage you as industry to, again, engage the behavior. You know, somebody that sticks a camera up on a stick and spies on their neighbor is still outside of our social contract. They're still a pervert, right? They're still at the tails of the bell curve. If they use a drone to do it, we still think that about that person. And we hope that you don't think that about drones, basically. It's still just the human being that's operating it. So, and is that a...
Thank you. Yeah, that's good. Mm.
The use of these unmanned systems will be as much a part of our everyday living and our culture 10 years from now as cell phones are today. My name is Rick Spinrad. I'm the Vice President for Research at Oregon State University. This technology, it's almost limitless what this can apply to.
This is the kind of technology that comes along once in a while that, if made available, it'll change the lives of the people using it, and it's going to save the lives of the people we go out into the public to try and get.
I see this as a great tool for any farmer. Survey the area without meeting anybody on the outside, and then analyze the imagery, probably uploading it to the cloud to a service.
We have a mantra organizationally. Westwind, that we seek to tell the story of life through water. So how do we do that in a authentic and scientific way? You know, how do we both tell the story but also continue to be stewards? And suddenly you have the entire Earth that needs, you know, the attention that this technology can bring.
I think the number of ways UAVs can be applied for public good is just beginning to be realized.
We're going to change the world with this technology, and we need your help.
We can pioneer the regulatory and ultimately the cultural embrace of using this technology.
There's no better time to get into this. And this competition gives you the perfect opportunity to try something new and give back in a way that's never been done before.
Think about how you could help your local community.
Reach out to land managers, ranchers, farmers. Anybody who's dealing with large area that they got to manage is going to welcome contributions from UAV, UAS hobbyists.
I think every department in America would have an application where it would be useful.
I would just encourage hobbyists to get involved, but to follow the rules.
Understand the FAA guidelines. Reach out to your local community and have fun.
So help your community, enter Drone Prize, and win.
The grand prize is going to be a heavy lift multi-rotor system.
We're going to bring the finalists out here to Oregon, and we'll have our fly-off
for our final competition.
With unmanned aerial systems, you know, the sky's the limit.
How can your perspective change the world?
Come join us in Oregon and be part of the Silicon Skies.
Do you want to come join the Silicon Sky?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, then we've done our job. Now, all honesty, we are looking for this to be a national press event this finals here this summer. It's still, you can tell, it's still in draft form. But we are looking to get policymakers involved in that conversation as well. And so I've actually met with Secretary of State Kate Brown already about this, and she's helping me sort of understand the political lay of the land of who would like to champion the technology. And this is a narrative vehicle on your side of the table as well, to, if you're that champion, that we'd invite you to join us in that narrative. So that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you so very, very much. Jonathan, can you address Representative Reardon's earlier question about the application of pesticides and fertilizers?
Actually, I'm going to...
I'm sorry, that. Jeff.
Not at all.
Yeah, he's got it on his slide.
I have the right slides for it,
okay.
Chairman.
Please go.
First of all, thank you again for inviting us to come today. And so I'm Jeff Lorton, and I'm the economic development guy for Yamhill County. I'm a contractor. I'm actually in advertising, and I'm on a one-year contract to kickstart the Yamhill County Economic Development Office, start it up. And part of that process was myself and my business partner to look at Yamhill County and look for strategic opportunities for Yamhill County. First of all, I'd like to say that these guys and so many other guys and gals are driving this in the state of Oregon and regionally in the Pacific Northwest. The Cascade, or the AUVSI, which is a national organization, there's a regional chapter called the Cascade Chapter, of which Jonathan's a board member. The test sites. Eric Simpkins, he would probably not tell you this, but he was a major architect of the entire Pan-Pacific Complex application. Worked very closely with the Geophysical Institute at the University of Alaska, and spent a lot of time, if I'm not mistaken, in sub-zero temperatures in a trailer, writing and writing and writing to make this happen. Companies like Ryan's, are major innovators and have been working directly with farmers, again, kickstarting this well ahead of implementation. And it's exactly where we need to be, because that's where all the other states are going too. And, in fact, there are many states pouring millions of dollars into their land-grant universities for the research of unmanned aerial systems, Nebraska, Kansas, Virginia. They are huge into this, and we're lucky that we have so many great people that without the funding have been doing it anyway here in Oregon and getting us to the level that we are. The question I think it's fair to ask is why is, Yamhill County gone gaga for drones? It is this guy's fault, the guy that you just saw on video. This is Eric Folkstead. He's the president of the Cascade Chapter of the AUVSI. He is also an engineer with an unmanned aerial systems company called Arcturus down in California. He lives in Vancouver, so he's practically an Oregonian. We certainly feel that way about him. And he is an amazing spokesperson. When I first met Eric, I met Eric at an aviation cluster conference. It was like I was 2 weeks on the job with Yamhill County, and I was invited by my contact at Business Oregon, Mitchell G., who looks after Marion Polk in Yamhill Counties. He invited me to this aviation cluster meeting. I sat down. Eric was speaking, and Eric asked a really, really great question, which kicked off something that now has been kind of a six-month odyssey for myself and my county commissioners. And the question was, what is the most popular commercial UAV in the world? And nobody raised their hands in the room. A bunch of aviation people, nobody raised their hands. The answer is this, the Yamaha R-Max. The Yamaha R-Max is about a 600-pound dirt bike-sized helicopter that sprays crops. In fact, it sprays 95% of all the crops in Japan. There are
2,500 in operation in Japan, and they have been operating them since the 80s. There are over 20,000 licensed operators of this helicopter, and today they're flying the RMAX down in California on their second year of trials with UC Davis. Yamaha is working together with UC Davis. I'm going to get more into that. But you can see the growth curve here for the use of the RMAX in Japan. It has been steady, and probably the most interesting development is when did it leave Japan and where did it go? And Australia was the first stop. There were four Yamaha RMAXs licensed to operate in Australia last year, and I believe that they, I've been told by Steve Markowski, the director of the unit here in Oregon for Yamaha, that they are placed an order for an additional 12. The way that the Yamaha RMAX, it's a big helicopter, and so you can't buy one. You know, you cannot buy one. It is a lease operation system because it's an aircraft. It requires maintenance. It has a certain lifespan, which is about 1,000 hours of use before it has to come out of service. And so this, but what you'll notice is that in, you know, Australia, there's a website you can go to where you can order up this service. You can actually lease these equipment from Yamaha. You can become a certified operator. You can create a company that operates these companies for a variety of different crop and agricultural uses. And that's wide open right now. And so there's a boom in this in Australia at the moment. And this, we hope, will come here. So after the aviation cluster meeting at Evergreen Air and Space Museum last September, my next step was to go out to the AUVSI Cascades quarterly meeting in Pendleton.
Jeff, yes. I'm going to have to apologize, but we're going to have to, a number of the committee members are going to have to leave here
because
okay. they've got other 10 o'clock appointments. I apologize for that, mm-hmm. but could you hit right to the heart of what improvements can we see in terms of the applications?
Sure. Well, absolutely. Why don't we we'll see if it works this time. And
quick time when available.
Okay, it's not going to work. That's quite all right. I would recommend that you Google Yamaha RMAX, R-M-A-X, and UC Davis, and you can see it in operation on top of grapes right now in California. The professor in charge of that project, his name is Ken Giles. He came up here and spoke at a small conference that I organized in last November on unmanned aerial and farming. I'm just going to skip right through and get to the meat of it. And the meat of it is, so I organized this conference last November in Yamhill County. These are some of the speakers from OSU, Bosch Precision Ag, UC Davis, UC Ryan there, another professor from OSU. These are farmers, mostly, that attended this conference. There's an enormous appetite and desire to get involved in unmanned aerial systems with Oregon farmers. We had a great little trade show. We had a great demonstration. And what's next is this. So this speaks directly to the public interaction piece, the questions that were asked. One is that Ryan has been very generous with his time with both Engineering Aeronautical Space Academy at the Evergreen Space Museum, Air and Space Museum. It's a high school program. The kids go to high school at the museum. It's like a STEM program. Ryan has offered to be a science advisor to that program. I helped kind of put that together with some board members and instructors there. So we have high school students that are now getting involved with unmanned aerial systems, specifically to work on an agricultural project. Another was Ryan was generous enough to get involved with Chemeketa College, and I'm working with the Dean of Ag at Chemeketa to also stand up some kind of UAV research project as well. And then lastly is Yamhill County. What we're doing is we're putting on the 2.0, and in this case it's a 3.0 of our conference that we did last November. So on April 2nd and 3rd, we will have a two-day Precision Agriculture Expo at the museum, and it will not just feature unmanned aerial systems, although I brought this slide for that. but it actually will feature robotics, remote data, and we have a slate of speakers coming, not just from across the United States, and I mean top speakers, the head of robotics for John Deere, and many other fantastic speakers, both from the university systems and the commercial, but also we have a speaker coming from France who's bringing a robot that drives through the vineyard and actually physically prunes the vines and collects geospatial data while it does it. And environmental data, it's going to be a rather big deal. And this is part of that outreach. And, you know, really, I have three county commissioners that speak UAV and speak precision agriculture. They've really gotten behind this, the idea of this, and for this reason. Agriculture is central to our culture in Oregon, and it is central to our economy in Oregon. Everything in Oregon, all economic sectors cross through the nexus of agriculture in one way or another, and certainly they do in Yamhill County. And what we are primarily interested in is we are interested in the in Yamhill County, the 2,500 individual farm owners that we have in Yamhill County, and helping them remain sustainable and viable, and stave off consolidation, because the more farmers and farm families that we have in Oregon, the better off our state's culture is. And also, they make, you know, I mean, in Oregon, 14-year-olds drive combines on a regular basis, and that means they are disproportionately mechanically inclined. When they break, they fix them. And that is important to our state because it helps us with a workforce for advanced manufacturing as well. And there's an enormous opportunity here. We have a $5.5 billion ag industry, as you know. It's a $300 billion industry nationwide. Unmanned aerial systems and other forms of precision agriculture are going to add hundreds of millions of dollars to the Oregon economy in the next decade.
Tremendous. Before he leaves, can you gentlemen answer Representative Reardon's earlier question? Can you describe very briefly for us the impact that unmanned aerial systems will have on the volume of chemicals used, the specificity, the runoff, those sorts of things?
I can. It is extremely precise. And the video that I hope to show you was Ken Giles, a professor from UC Davis, directly speaking to that. Right now, crop dusting, the aircraft have to fly fairly fast because they have to remain airborne. It's dangerous to fly low, so they can't go too low. So they tend to put a lot of chem out. The same with foggers being drugged behind tractors. The RMAX helicopter that I showed you, it flies at about 16 miles an hour. It flies at just 1 or 2 meters over the top of the crop that it's spraying, and it only will spray where it's told to spray. So spot application and very, very precise application and reduced application are major benefits. Another benefit is the being low, the downdraft actually will push the applicants, the chem, down into the mid-canopy level. So again, using very little chem, they can have a very accurate application.
And I'd also piggyback onto what Ryan Jensen said earlier as well, that there's a sort of a idea of a full cycle robotics growing here, where you can start with the sensing. So you have the information gathering and the kind of precision that Ryan taught us. And then that is directly informing the autopilot and dispensing unit, the robot that's dispensing it, in a full circle biofeedback rhythm. And that's when we start to actually see the robotics and the artificial intelligence start to look a lot like the biological system itself.
Can we keep a database of how much chemicals are being applied?
Oh, absolutely.
You have to by federal law, I believe.
Sure, and not only that. So UC Davis sprayed water last year and did testing with card paper, you know, throughout vineyards. And this year they have a permit to test chem. And so they're actually going to be spraying, I believe this month they're spraying. Okay. But of course, everything gets pushed up to the cloud and will be instantly accessible to not only regulatory bodies, but also the farmers themselves.
Dying to know more.
Good.
And with that,
good.
Senator Roblin.
I just want to say, for the record, it was really nice of you to make sure that my district got had an opportunity today from the beginning, yes, the earlier one,
yes,
to this one. Near Space Research is in the northernmost portion of my district.
Very, very good.
For those of you that don't know, when you're driving the coast and you see those blimp hangars, it got its start in those hangars. They rented a part of it to make it work for 18 or so years. And for many people who saw the person jump out of the balloon in Near Space and make the big way back, the platform he jumped off of, That balloon was made in Tillamook, Oregon, at the Near Space Research facility. They've been doing this for a long time, and they have a launch site over in Hawaii. So, I mean, this is a perfect organizational group to bring the group together that got this test site. And I really appreciate it. We look forward to a lot of things on the coast that can happen. So I had to mention that. So thank you.
We're very grateful for the opportunity to come speak to you.
Thank you so very much. I want to thank all of you who came today. Your presentation and your enthusiasm is infectious. Thank you so very, very much. With that, I'm going to close the informational hearing, and I am going to adjourn the February 27, 2014 session of the House Ag and Natural Resources Committee.